I get up each morning, to the barber shop I go. I take off my hat, roll up my sleeve, and then I'm ready to mow. I shave men's beard, cut women's hair, from 8 o'clock till 6. I'd be better off if I was on the farm, away out in the sticks. When I first learned to barber, I was awkward as could be. I would nick men's hair, burn their face, and cut off their goatee. One day a farmer come to town with whiskers long and matted. I called his bluff, but I'm sorry now, for I was too sad.
You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. Each time I come through Lemon, driving, or on business, my eye has been caught by the pretty spinning old-fashioned red, blue, and white of the barber pole, which is perhaps the most effective and principal advertising figurine in the history of such things. I have seen nothing so drawing, so enticing, as the barber pole, and I have always had a slight self-disgruntlement for my parsimony on such matters, and have long wished to utilize the services of a professional barber. I have yearned to settle around the cozy wash of magazines in the little waiting alcove while listening to the laundry-clean mazurkas of the piped-in music, finally to be called over to take a seat in that remarkable mechanical chair, its chassis bolted to the floor, and thereupon be so deftly serviced by a gentleman who has been perfectly trained for the endeavour. I have also wondered why, in the more explosive cities like New York or Boston, the barber pole is not more fully exploited, for its hypnotic effect is an unbeatably supreme storefront pull. Bakeries have their sense of sugar and yeast, and such aromatic exhaust stirring in the local causeway will most definitely coax one in on a feather. My abstemiousness has, however, prevented me from ever consulting a barber. It is not exactly a cheapness, but an efficiency and a smartness, a lean way of living I inherited from my parents. I have always cut my own hair, and before I had the patience or inclination, my mother did it for me. I have, since about the age of 15, when my hair finally grew back after its loss in the fire, and I took hold of the job, used a combination of an electric trimmer, which I glide up the vertical flanks of my head to the beginning crest of my scalp, and then a scissors, which makes a rough transition of the rest. I thus have always had a rather rocky and reckless sort of old-fashioned cut, half military, half lunatic. But I can manage the ordeal in 10 minutes with my eyes closed if I wish, and it lasts the longest and is easiest to keep clean, while yet permitting, with the aid of some pomade, a slight veering style. With age, however, and the onset of arthritis, or rheumatism, or whatever it is that buries the hands in their own dirt, I no longer have the strength or dexterity I once did. The slightest rotation of the hair clipper blasts a rollicking pain in my wrist, and my fingers now regularly fail to register any action inside the holster of the scissors. These are the two children of old age, pain and loss of function. As my hands were now like shipwrecks, and my hair rusty and wild. I headed with some excitement into town to pay a visit to the local lemon barber shop. I parked my black 1961 Ford Galaxy Starliner before the Diggett's Hardware, as the meters there are all broken, and strolled along before the dozen or so shops, all small and gritty and semi-crucial. A diner, a grocer, a haberdasher, a men's and women's clothes shop, a penny candy store, a bookstore full of used thrillers and romances, and several other unwelcoming shops that willfully failed to be detected. I thus felt a sharp measure of anticipation as I was about to finally permit the hypnotic barber pole to have its way with me. I was going to have a haircut, and from my perspective, it was the pole that would be doing the cutting. It would, at least, most certainly, get the credit in my imagination for the sale. I would sit in the reading room and read a magazine I'd never read, Home and Garden or Reader's Digest, and overhead, in a ceiling speaker, the long violins would excrete their vitamin-depleted, plasticine symphony. And after a time, I would be called over. "How do you want it?" the barber would ask, and I will tell him what I always told my mother when she asked, and what I have since then dreamt of saying to a barber, as my mother always turned me down. "I'd like to look like a race car robber," I will say. I no longer am as clearly connected to its meaning, nor remember why I was so eager to have my mother craft my hair in such a style, but it was one of the few strong positions I held as a boy. "We can't have that," my mother would say, denying my request, in favor of another in the bottomless pit of bowl cuts I got as a child. "Then why ask?" I always wanted to know. It seemed to me when I was young, and even now, I suppose, that adults are always asking me questions and never obliging my wishes. So why ask? "Do what you please if that's what you'll do, regardless of my input. Never mind the dark, grabbing hope of my coincidental approval." But to have the cut of a race car robber was to my young self the height of decadence. With such a cut, so my boyhood thinking went, my life would be a thing of adrenalized substance. One charging excitement would follow another. I would be a race car robber, wearing a fancy hat, with a getaway plan, a girl on each hip, and candy in every pocket. In short, I would be someone different than I was, a bored and boring boy with a bowl haircut who strolled glossy-eyed around the neighborhood, failing to find something interesting to occupy his freedom. With such a cut, I imagined I would be wild and frivolous, happy and reckless. Someone who smiled as they slept with the wolves out under the stars. Someone whose mother asked what sort of cut he wanted and then gave it to him. Not to be nice, but because he asked. Because it was his world that counted, his opinion that mattered. Thank you. There was no Home and Garden, and there was no Reader's Digest, but there was the bland landscape of lunatic asylum music that I'd hoped for. It draped over me like a spillage of corn syrup and meadowgrass. Rising, wide strings, and needlessly grotesque zithers kissed together their saccharine romance. I took a seat just inside the shadows of the waiting room on a low, fake leather couch in a place where I could still see the pole spinning its enticements just outside the door. There were some magazines and books for children, and some pamphlets that offered advice to the elderly, as well as a hand-dirty and pocket-crunched brochure that pitched the efforts of the Bradleton Fair, which was coming to the next town over. I examined this leaflet briefly. There would be rides and games, and freakish animals and vegetables, and strongman contests, and everyone was invited to spend the afternoon in the 80-year-old grandstands, watching the excitement of the 100-mile stock car race. But none of the material before me could hold my interest. I was much too excited by the unnatural music, the overlapping, soapy fragrance of the place, and the wickedly quick movements of its pair of barbers. For the shop smelled exotically of expensive coconut lathers and lemon rind, a very potent sprinkling zest upon the air, of shampoo and musky shaving creams that lifted my spirits considerably. I could sit here forever, I thought, in a kind of permanent lackluster drift. The music was oppressive, the smells overpowering, there was nothing to read, and I was absolutely happy. It was a two-chair setup, and its expert haircutters, dressed in the white garb of old-fashioned surgeons, were both making lightning work of their respective customers. The scissors flashed, the combs clicked in and out of their teeth, and both men clutched a brush or strop under his arm, and in the shirt pocket of each was a series of protruding sharp tools. Both middle-aged customers were well-dressed beneath their protective barber smocks, one in seersucker and saddle shoes, the other in tweed and highly polished floor shimes. The nearest customer, whose name I learned shortly was Leonard, was tall and thin, with rather floppy limbs and salmon-coloured skin, while his friend, Tuttle, was short and fat and ruddy, with big yellow pools on each cheek, which I took to indicate a bad heart. They were a classic, Laurel and Hardy couple, and I imagined them both dying very shortly from long-ignored internal ailments. Just prior to my entering the shop, I saw that they were engaged in a heated argument, which was stifled immediate to my entry. Barber 1 and Barber 2, both of them brightly, shiningly bald, and fashionably unshaven, nodded at me, and one of them checked the comb from his teeth, long enough to call out, "Take a seat, be right with you." I sat and reveled in the barberiness of the shop. I looked over the huge wall mirror and along the narrow shelf that ran below it, upon which hundreds of bottles and squeeze tubes and jugs of talc and soaps and hair products stood for fresh use. There were also dozens of narrow clear glass vessels filled with different coloured chemical waters, blue, yellow, rose and red, within which stood a vast array of the barber's surgery-level tools, scissors and blades and sharp pointy things all shining silver. And I thought to myself, well, I ought to have entered this barbering trade myself. I would have done it well, and I would have always been comforted. For everything here, every tool, powder, and accoutrement, the sound, the solidity of the chairs, the idea of the cozy magazines, the certainty and limitation and micro-importance of the haircutter's task, spoke to me of a kind of safety I had never been able to manifest. Here I would be safe all my day long, cutting hair beneath the pouring down sugar of terrible music and buffeted in the big-time smell of lemons and coconuts. No need to talk, I'd be so focused on my work. First the cropper's scissors, then the thinning scissors, then the blade along the back of the neck, followed by a white foam brought out on my hand, then pressed, disappearing upon the black hair. An application of this astringent, a splash of this new brand of tea nettles. Yet a moment following the pretty picture of my dream, I realized the strange fact that if it were my shop, I would have discarded every bit of excess and had only one set of scissors, one comb, one jug of shampoo, and no music or awful magazines. Much of what I liked about the shop as a client, I would not be able to tolerate from an owner's vantage. Thus, despite the fact that the munificence, the dramatic overstock, the boisterous ampleness of the products and gear directly heartened me, I would not allow it if I were the boss. Perhaps I was meant to live among a heavenly clutter, and yet was following the opposite precept for some reason. I played a philosopher in a long-ago play entitled Hebrides Denies All, and the one winning line I had went, "Who can say? None can say." So to my self-inquiry around my Spartan lifestyle, as it ran against my pleasure in this palace of odors and equipment, I found myself mumbling, "Who can say? None can say."
Good morning, Miss Snip, Snip, Snip. But your haircut is as short as mine. Good morning, Miss Snip, Snip, Snip. But your haircut is as short as mine. Pair room, lucky tiger, booty wax, crack attack, shoe shine, jaw break a magazine wax. Hang around the barbershop, sideburning clothes, scrapping on a Mr. Ferguson. What's a good word with you? Staying out of trouble like a good boy should. I see still cutting hair, still cutting classes. Got a couple passes to the ring, brush, pound, pin, circus afternoon. Lost a little round the middle, you looking real good. I'm sitting on the wagon's little under the hood. What's low down, Mr. Brown? I heard your boys leaving town. I bought myself a struggle bug and suckers powder blue. Throw me over sports page. Series for the done, the hair's getting longer. You know the skirts are getting shorter. I don't you know that you can get a cheaper haircut if you won't cross the border. Your mama's only smoking with you, kick your ass. And you put it out, you juvenile, put it out fast. Well, if I had $1 million, what would I do? Probably be a barber, not a bum like you. Still got your paper out, now that's just fine. And you can pay me double, cause you chipped me last time.
As I was curious to hear the natural sounds of a barber shop, I picked up a children's magazine and pretended to read, hoping to encourage the cartoon couple of Tall Leonard and Short Tuttle to resume their animosities, and a few moments later they began to quietly potshot one another with quips and insults. They were barely audible, and yet I slowly began to understand that Tall Leonard felt that Short Tuttle had slighted him. In fact, it seemed that the short fat man had stolen something from the tall thin man, and yet the short man was not willing to admit this. The barbers continued to slash their blades with military precision, as though the scissors were fighter jets drop-zipping out of the sky their laser attacks. And Leonard and Tuttle soon forgot about the old gentleman magazine reader on the too-low couch in the waiting room and shoved back into the thick of their argument. "You did it," Leonard said with a slight drawl. "Admit it and we'll call it even." Tuttle ground his teeth, the yellow spots on his cheek pulsing. "I didn't. You know I didn't. You know I would never." "Who else would take it, Tuttle?" Leonard shouted. "I don't know," Tuttle said, truly mystified. "When you get something stolen from you, it's not like you know who did it." Leonard checked his watch. "They're all there now. Probably 20 cars lined up. judges checking the engines, drivers dressed, track freshly graded. We should be there, Tuttle. We're ready. But then you had to go and take it, Leonard said, outraged. Tuttle began to hyperventilate dramatically. I'm upset too, Leonard. I'm upset too, he said. I've been waiting 2 years for this. Just so you know, Leonard said, I'm still going to the race. And I swear to you, even if it's painted, I'll be able to pick our car out. And when I find out that you took it, you don't even want to know how much trouble you're in. Don't forget who my brother is. I didn't have it painted, Tuttle shouted. Then you admit you took it, Leonard cried. Why would I take my own car? Tuttle said. It was a good question, I thought. I turned the page of my magazine. I was looking down at a watercolor picture of an owl talking to a woodchuck. You knew that we'd have a good shot, Leonard said. If we did win, and we would have, then we'd get to step up to the Cup Series. And if that happened, Leonard said, growing a little sad. If that happened. Both men disappeared briefly into the dreamy result of stepping up into the Cup Series. Tuttle's barber suddenly tossed off his client's protective smock. He swept the man's shoulders fiercely with a horsehair brush and spun him around to the mirror for his review. Tuttle turned his head side to side. Good, he said softly, and slowly rolled his bulk forward out of the chair. For a last time in love of God, Tuttle said. Why would I take my own car, Leonard? Because you got a new partner, Leonard suggested. Why would I get rid of you and get a new partner? Tuttle shouted into the air. Because you hate my guts, Leonard said. Always have. Leonard laid back in his chair, as though with this damning evidence he could now be crowned champion of the debate. Tuttle took his watch from the product shelf and clasped it over his wrist before rolling his dress sleeves down. He shook his head sadly. You're my best friend, Leonard, Tuttle said, and then, surprisingly, stomped his foot, puffing the feathery locks of hair across the linoleum floor. Exactly, Leonard said, as though this were the stomp of a guilty car thief. And as the yellow pools on Tuttle's ruddy face flared and he began to move angrily out of the shop, Leonard called out, Why don't you just head over to the jail? 'Cause that's where you're going, pal. See you at the race, buddy. Barber One, I saw now, was gibbering his index finger at me, indicating my turn in the chair. As I approached and sat, he went down on his knees and manically swept up the local floor with the same horsehair brush he'd used to clean Tuttle's shoulders. What you looking for in a cut? Any ideas? Does it matter? The barber shot at me in tight tones, and I realized at that moment that the only thing I'd ever wanted to say to a barber, the style of the cut that I long ago imagined would have some transformative power over my style of life, had been taken from me by the incendiary situation between Leonard and Tuttle, two men who apparently owned a racing car that had been stolen. I echoed his words, stalling for time. What kind of cut? I said, considering. The barber then pulled from a drawer a starchy sheet that bore the title, Hairstyles for Men. Below the title was a series of sketches of the same smiling man with different haircuts. Each cut had a different name. The Mariner, the Gentleman, On the Town, the Woodsman, the Hunter, Father Figure, Cock of the Block, the Scientist, the Swiss Clockmaker, and the Marauder. I was about to say that I'd take the Marauder-style cut, when it occurred to me that saying that I wanted the race car rubber cut would strangely stand me in the clear and establish me much more so in the manner of the person I had pretended to be, as a non-eavesdropping magazine reader. For if I had listened, I would never suggest such a thing, as it would be altogether much too ironically connected to the dispute between Leonard and Tuttle, which all proved to be a very poorly manufactured hypothesis. But so quickly and efficiently and most definitely, and as though it would go down exactly the way I imagined, I said, Can you give me the cut of a race car rubber? Leonard sat straight up in his chair, crying, So it was you! A malicious and meaty smile erupted on his face as he threw a long bony finger across the shop and poked me hard in the shoulder.
is a gun with a dart for my sweetheart. Two, only you can remove such an egg so. Stitches thread through my heart. Seven shiny reasons tearing us apart. Ain't lose your hate, it's a game. Come on, love me, it's your fate.
After being attacked by the power finger of Tall Leonard, I felt sure he would challenge me to some not-at-all-possible fight. It is strange how purely unable one becomes after a certain age. Pain and a loss of function, as I said, are the two children of old age. I could not throw a single punch into a pillow without my entire body shattering to smithereens. Thus, I ruminated on the ways in which a very old person might escape the positionings of such a challenge, when Leonard instead showed himself to be overcome with a sudden great fear of me, perhaps computing in his tall person's mind the reasonability of some concomitant tendency in me to violence. If I stole his car, it was possible that I had killed a man. I could have a weapon on me, a gun in my pocket, a knife in a leather garter hidden under a pant leg. So he went cluster-kicking upward from the chair, like a wild horse expelling itself from some small hole in the ground. And as he attempted to rip off the barber smock, his leather shoes began skimming comically over the soft greasing of his own brown hair, which coated the floor beneath him. And I could not help, because of his unaccountable terror, and the resulting slapstick of his retreat, to laugh a little at his expense, which I saw by his wide eyes, cemented the fact of my being the wicked malefactor. Leonard finally got his feet under him, and although he could not remove the smock, he did shortly make his escape from me. And as the barbershop door tingled shut, we settled back into place. The second barber stepped up into Leonard's chair and sat with a newspaper, while my barber began his preparations, drawing a battened half bowl behind my head full of warm water and commencing a shampoo. I attempted to release the upsetting conflict in the coddling sensation of the waters, for it must be said that whenever one is accused of something, one feels at least faintly guilty of the crime. So within my head a torrent of wondering had commenced. Had I, in fact, somehow stolen the car? It was impossible, but Leonard's outrageous behavior laid a convincing groundwork. My black 1961 Ford Galaxy Starliner hardtop had been included in the purchase of the cabin. It came equipped with a little St. Christopher statuette on the dashboard, I had spent a small pile of money getting it running, as I thought the car looked exactly like my favorite hat, or at least the automotive version of my favorite hat. And despite the fact that I didn't exactly want a car, I supposed I needed it. It had been gently pecked at by an earlier hailstorm, but it was otherwise very nicely intact, with a baby blue interior, and it lacked seat belts, which I found charmingly rebellious. But I did wonder, was it possible that my Ford Galaxy was somehow owned by Tall Leonard and Short Tuttle? It was the only material I could push forward in my mind, yet it was not acceptable to view it that way. The impression given was of two men laboring over their stock car, preparing it for the Bradleton Fair races. There was one striking coincidence, however. Although I was not much of a driver, I had to admit that my Ford Galaxy was rather swift in the field. From the start, I had noticed a frightening explosiveness to the throttle. It was an extremely hard car to drive slowly. It occurred to me, as the barber began to dry my hair and run a comb over my scalp, that Tall Leonard was not only running away from my dangerous person, but he was also, and maybe more so, running toward something, or someone else, for help. A light, drizzling chill ran down my sides as I ventured to ask, "Where did Leonard rush off to, do you think?" "Police," my barber said. The second barber commented, "Leonard's brother is the chief." "Should I be expecting anything?" I said. "They'll probably come over here," my barber said. "And then what?" I asked. "That's up to you. We're just hoping to get your cut done and get paid before they arrive." He took the scissors to my hair and made one quick cut before I stopped him. I sat forward, placed a $20 bill on the counter, unlooped the hair smock from my neck, returned the hat to my head, and set out for my car. "Not finished," my barber called out. I allowed myself to turn briefly. "You have achieved the correct look," I said. And perhaps it was not necessarily the fact of a kind of hairstyle that gave one the look of a race car robber, but more so the kind of reality one found oneself entering. I felt a bubble of excitement as I stepped out of the shop. I was, at least a little bit, a wanted man, a troublemaker. The fact that I had not stolen the car both reassured me and gave me some swagger. At the bottom of it, I had nothing to worry about. But I was probably in for some cross-examining. And perhaps I did not look it, not according to the style pages or the cinema, but in the natural setting of being misconceived as such. I believe it may be said that as much as possible, because I was believed to be one, I now had the haircut of a race car robber. I crossed lengthwise toward Diggett's Hardware, and just as I started up the Galaxy, I saw the police cruiser pulling in front of the barber shop. I backed out slowly, watching in the mirror, as three men, Short Tuttle, Tall Leonard, and Leonard's police chief brother, hopped quickly out into the shop, looking for their criminal. A light touch on the pedal, and the Galaxy bolted forward. I was only lost to my purpose for a moment. Reasonable or not, I made the detective's judgment that Leonard and Tuttle's car had been stolen for one purpose alone: to be raced. If I had stolen it, smart or not, I would have taken it for that reason. I wish I could say that my foot made deep work of the accelerator pedal, but it was like I was nubbing my toe at a pebble, trying to coax it off a ledge. So with a soft and subtle foot, I lofted up into the speeds, and the plastic St. Christopher statue on the dashboard went bobbling side to side as I began my criminal's escape down the interstate, heading toward the Bradleton racetrack, where I hoped to find someone else with the sort of ultra-terrible hairstyle that I myself had, that of a race car robber.
Dog, kick me out. up my own ball and throw me out in the fall. Tear a hole in the jackpot, drive a stake through his heart. Do 100 on the grapevine, do a jump on the start. Hang on, St. Christopher, now don't let me go. Get me to Reno and bring it in low, yeah.
Been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.